Welcome. You are listening to the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Seminar Series. I'm the Center's Director, Ann Stevens. This series brings scholars and policy experts from around the country to discuss their work on poverty and poverty research. In October 2012, we hosted Douglas Allman, the Center's Fall Visiting Scholar. He is an Associate Professor of International and Public Affairs and Economics at Columbia, and previously served as Staff Economist at the Council of Economic Advisors during the Clinton administration. As a Fulbright Scholar, he studied the health effects of air pollution in China. Here is Allman presenting his seminar, Fetal Origins and Anti-Poverty Policies.
Thank you. So thank you for that very nice introduction, and thank you for hosting me, Ann and Mary Ann, this week. It's been a great visit so far, and you know, it compares well with all my other visits, and the one that I think of is the one to Beijing 10 years ago to NBR conference, where I felt I was treated particularly well. And your hosting, I think, is at that high level. Beijing 10 years ago. And just to frighten Hillary a little bit, I'll also add to my sort of CV that I was Hillary's student at Berkeley X years ago. So apologies in advance for this talk. So in econ, the rules of engagement are you're welcome to interrupt me at any time, so please feel free to do that. I won't take it as rude or anything like that. And as suggested, I'm going to sort of do a sort of uber discussion of some of the recent and important work on fetal origins. Okay, so by way of motivation, obviously, I think there's an audience where we think that childhood is very important, and there are lots of 9-month periods in our life that are very important. So a month ago, our daughter Abigail started kindergarten at the Columbia School, and she has an awesome teacher, and she's learning a lot. Actually, she's learning much more than I thought she would. I wasn't sure she was going to buy into it, but she's really coming home every day with something new she's learned that she wants to tell me. So this is going to be a very important 9 months. What I think the fetal origins hypothesis asks us to do is to think about 5 years ago, because she's actually starting kindergarten age 4, when she was in utero. And how important was that 9-month period relative to this very important 9-month period right now? And so this is a picture of her in utero. Okay. With consent of the mom, I'll tell you. So the fetal origins hypothesis basically says that the prenatal foundation lays the foundation on which the rest of childhood is built. And I saw this definition recently, which I liked from Seckel, which is referring to fetal programming as the action of a factor during a sensitive period or window of development to exert organizational effects that persist throughout life. Okay, so something, so fundamental architecture is being affected. And as the next point repeats, these outcomes persist throughout the rest of life. So with, you know, many other interventions, people are concerned about fade out over time. And fetal origins is a place where from the get-go, we're thinking less about fade out. Partly for just the practical reason is the early analyses are looking at stuff that happened very early on and then looking at adult outcomes. So sort of while there may be fade out, it's not going to be complete fade out because we're still finding effects in adulthood. In epidemiology, and we discussed sort of the role of the epidemiological literature more in this JEP article that Ann nicely mentioned, it's often associated with a physician named D.J. Barker, and he did a lot of sort of original data analysis in England looking at correlations and regression-adjusted correlations between measures of early life health and later life chronic health conditions. This work by Barker some 20 years ago was actually a reaction against an earlier literature which viewed the fetus as the perfect parasite. So basically, if there was adversity during the prenatal period, the mom was a very good buffer, and she sort of absorbed the bad event and protected the fetus. Smoking rates into the 1950s and 1960s in the U.S. were something like, you know, going up to around 50% during pregnancy. And it was by many people's reckonings, the thalidomide episode, which sort of shattered this notion that the mom is protecting the fetus from every insult. So a natural question is what matters to the fetus and its long-run outcomes in utero. And the original hypothesis that came to us, again, from epidemiology, focused on prenatal nutrition and how much and what the mother eats. The most studied famine in probably both economics and in epidemiology is the Dutch famine of 1944 to 1945. And there are a couple of reasons why this famine was sort of particularly appealing to analyze. One is that it was a fairly short famine and fairly unexpected. So, you know, the Netherlands did pretty well despite being occupied until the Nazis cut off food shipments, and then there was a sudden and unexpected famine. And furthermore, it happened in a country that actually had good data. Usually we have famines in places where the data are pretty bad. So those are a couple of reasons why these cohorts have been particularly studied. And what do they find? Well, they find a whole host of chronic health conditions in adulthood that are compromised. The initial studies looked at cognitive outcomes among military recruits, and that was back in 1975, and didn't find much. But as these cohorts have aged, they found heart disease, hypertension, obesity, all these things responding to the prenatal environment. One sort of piece of subtext here that I'm probably more interested in than other people is this literature has been actually pretty contentious within epidemiology. And one of the reasons why I think it's been contentious within epidemiology is the role of birth weight, okay? So the cohort that seems to be most negatively affected by the Dutch famine tends to be those exposed during the first half of pregnancy, whereas when you look at the birth outcomes of the Dutch famine, the ones with the largest decrease in birth weight are those exposed in the second half of pregnancy. So there are a lot of people who really thought that the Dutch famine the exclusion restriction should hold for birth weight, that birth weight should pick up the long-run effect of the famine, and that wasn't being found. So granted they have a good natural experiment, but people are sort of kind of confused at why birth weight wasn't the metric to capture that. And I think now, over the last couple of years, people have said, well, you know, this sort of says that there's a need for other metrics. And that's actually going to be a point I come back to a couple times later, is a real challenge in this literature is the absence of a good early life metric. Because we're forced to look at these, you know, if we're really going to analyze long-run effects, we have to go back in time to look at a historical event or treatment back in the past. If we had that metric, we wouldn't have to be doing economic history all the time, okay? But in the absence of such a metric, we're sort of forced to do that. Okay, so now I'm going to sort of wave the economics flag a little bit here. What are the contributions economists have made to this field? So I'll sort of try and distill these into three, and then talk about more recent work. One is to say it's not just about famines. It's more general than thinking about famine exposures. Not to say famines aren't important and ongoing, and they're, you know, obviously they're very important for the history of human evolution, et cetera, but economists have sort of, in some sense, been a little bit liberated from the biology to consider other things that the epidemiologists hadn't really posited mechanisms for. Secondly, economists are very interested in things other than health. So actually the original incarnation of my job market paper was looking at health outcomes, and then I sort of thought, you know, it'd actually be even more interesting to consider things like wages and that sort of thing. And in some sense, the data in the census were particularly well suited to that. So expanding beyond health to consider a whole manner of other things. And then the third thing, which, you know, probably I'll talk about more than I should, is about the convincingness of the evidence. So I'll briefly develop these three points before proceeding to sort of some of the more recent literature. So famine's effects, famine is a very severe event. And in some sense, if you do something sufficiently bad to a mom while she's pregnant, it's kind of plausible that there would be an injury, okay? And so what economists have done is consider things that aren't quite as severe as famines. And so one of the things economists have looked at is the disease environment. So looking at, pandemic influenza and malaria exposure, wartime stress, ionizing radiation, a whole gamut of early life exposures beyond famine have been studied. So it seems to be more general than just about famine. Secondly, as mentioned, people have looked at a lot of other outcomes besides just health outcomes, not to say health isn't important, but things like test scores. So the whole literature, obviously is concerned with educational inputs and impacts on test scores. Well, we can sort of engage that literature a little bit by saying, what are the effects of income during early childhood on test scores or that sort of thing. And the thing that gets many education economist people kind of upset, maybe not upset's not quite the right word, but is that the impacts tend to be often as large or larger than conventional educational interventions, okay? So despite the brevity of the prenatal period, you can really have some outsized effects on things like test scores. Going beyond test scores to educational attainment, wages and incomes, and then other sort of more demographic stuff like whether you get married, the characteristics of your spouse, and the neighborhood you live in, welfare dependency, it actually, in some sense, becomes a problem, this big range of things that are affected, because it sort of restricts the set of falsification exercises we can perform, because it's not so obvious what should not be affected when you trigger something during the prenatal period. Okay, then the third thing is, like, why should you believe this? This sort of sounds like astrology in the sense, you're born at this particular time under a certain star, and then, like, this is how your life is going to be. And it's not just that. I think there is a lot of astrology-caliber research out there on the fetal origins hypothesis. People have heard this before, but I would say, the modal study in fetal origins is equating correlation with causation. I think that generated some of the controversy within epidemiology. At the risk of being just pedantic, it's not just correlation is not the same as causation. You can do regression analysis with a ton of control variables, and still, I'm not very convinced that we're getting closer to sort of causal inference there. So the paper that I'd like to sort of plug here just randomly, and I feel kind of comfortable doing this because this is actually not by an economist, despite what the title is, if you're in the situation where you think you might have omitted variables bias, does including more regressors help reduce that bias? And I think, the usual prior on that is if I control for more stuff, I reduce bias. And this paper makes the point that that's really not the case. Okay, you can actually often increase bias by sort of kitchen sinking your regression. And what they point to, and what I'm going to turn to next, is you'd like to be in a situation where what you control for really doesn't matter that much to the effect you're estimating. And so research design is sort of an alternative to sort of kitchen sinking our regression. Okay, so example one, and I apologize for taking these examples that are close to home, is the 1918 influenza in the United States. So one of the things that is notable about the 1918 influenza is it really appeared out of nowhere. This is September 1918 number of deaths per month, and then we go up by more than an order of magnitude in October of 1918. So this is just something that hit suddenly and out of blue, and after it was a really scary 4 or 5 months, and hundreds of thousands of people died, but after 4 or 5 months you get back down to sort of fairly normal death rates in the US. Okay, so if you think about the cohort that was born say around here, born around here, they were conceived prior to the arrival of the pandemic, so we don't think that their conception decision was affected by expectation of this flu, but But they were very likely to have a mom who got infected with the 1918 flu. So while it is the case that millions died from the 1918 flu, that's actually not the most common thing that happened. The most common thing that happened is you got infected, you were sick for a little while, and then you got better and you lived. So something like 1/3 of pregnant mothers got sick, whereas fewer than 1% of mothers died. To the extent that mothers did die or weak fetuses died, that's actually going to bias against us finding effects. So there is a culling effect that we need to sort of have floating around, particularly for famine episodes where mortality rates are even higher. But that's, at least at first pass, that's going to bias us against finding anything. So the question the flu paper asks is, if you happen to be in utero in the U.S. during the 1918 flu and conceived prior, how are you doing later in life? Well, so this is where the census data comes in. And so if you look in the 1960 census data, so this is 42 years after the flu pandemic, this plots the average educational attainment by the year of birth, okay? And there's this upward trend. So people in the U.S. Were getting more education over time. Part of that, I think, is due to the compulsory school laws that are inducing, later born cohorts to have more schooling. But the striking thing about this is you can sort of do the visual detrending. You see that the cohort born in 1919 is substantially off that trend, okay? And we can do a couple of additional comparisons. One is we can sort of dummy out this average drop for the 1919 cohort and look using the information on where people were born to see if in a difference in differences analysis, if being born in a state that had a worse pandemic leads to a larger decrease here. So a bigger drop here than if you were in a state with a milder pandemic. So, that helps to address concerns about, oh gosh, it was the end of the World War One. Maybe there are other changes. So those changes would have to be correlated with the severity of the pandemic around the U.S., which fortunately for analysis purposes was pretty idiosyncratic. We can also carry this forward to 1980 when these guys are in their early 60s and we see about, 20% more likely to be disabled if the mom was infected with flu and greater than 5% reduction in wages. Okay. Example number two is looking at Chernobyl fallout in Sweden. So again, we sort of have a similar figure here that this is the gamma radiation in sort of central eastern Sweden plotted daily 1985 and 1986. And what you see again is this huge spike that's shorter than the spike for the 1918 flu. And we can think about those cohorts that happened to be in utero at the time. Now, Sweden wasn't considered a Chernobyl hotspot. Yes, sorry.
When you first introduced the flu, you were careful to say that many folks would, many of the affected kids would already, the fertility choice would already have been made.
Yep.
And that's real helpful.
Yep.
For getting the convincing part right.
Yep.
You may be talking about this later, but of course you also need to worry a bit about survival to birth.
Yep.
And how that might play in it's a challenge in most any of these kinds of empirical settings that you're looking at.
Yep.
So I wonder whether you might want to just talk about that challenge or whether you're going to talk about it later.
Right. So that's exactly right. So I think the more plausible bias as opposed to people anticipating it,
right,
is that there is a selection effect. Fetuses are very vulnerable.
Right.
And so you just have part of the distribution that's getting sucked out by the event itself, and then we have sort of a survivor bias,
right,
later on in life. Okay, so let me give sort of a half answer to that. Depending on the thing considered, we may not have the data to look at fetal mortality and particularly during 1918, that's tough. And so what people have done and what we've done is to look at the number of births. So basically, if you account for sort of smooth trends in number of births, we should see a smaller cohort, you know, if say fetal mortality peaks, you know, in the first trimester or something like that, then we should see a smaller cohort. It turns out these things seem to be, this in particular seems to be sufficiently mild where we don't get fetuses vanishing. Where that will change, and I'll come to that in a second, kind of surprisingly, is Ramadan. You see a lot of missings there. So maybe I can come back to that a little bit, but that's exactly right. I think that's much more, particularly fetal mortality, because you know, obviously childhood mortality can increase as well, but that base level is so low that you're really stretched to generate, you know, much of an effect with childhood mortality. It would really have, I think the thing I usually worry about is the fetal mortality, because those rates are just much higher.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And a lot of people talk about the fertility piece, which I think for the most part, time and time again, we reject that that's what's changing.
Exactly. I totally agree. And so that's right. And we'll come back to this a little bit with Ramadan. With particularly with this, we're pretty confident we don't have to worry too much about that. I think the intuition still generally goes through that those that are most likely to die off are coming from the bottom of the distribution, and so that's gonna lead to attenuated effects in general. Yeah, but we'd like to know what those are, right? Like, because we'd like to. That's interesting in and of itself.
I just have before you switch to this slide, at the end of the last slide, you mentioned you said if the mothers had flu. You don't know if
we absolutely do not. So the very nice catch. Yeah.
So one thing that would have been differenced out in a state by state or region by region difference in the difference research design is stress on medical resources, because so it might be that the resources are moved away from prenatal care, or that people stay away from hospitals because they don't want to risk infection.
You're exactly right. And so a related point is, can we say that this was because the mom got influenza? Not really. Like, it could be just in places where there was high influenza infection rate, it was very stressful to be pregnant, and it could be that it literally was that. Had we did the data to observe, which influenza wasn't a reportable disease, we cannot observe the thing that which you very smartly caught, which is that we don't observe the individual, and to see whether it was really those people that were infected that are showing the long-term damage. That's absolutely right. So we cannot reject those things which mimic the variation of the pandemic. Now, prenatal care I'm not so worried about at this time as a confounder, because births tend to be outside of hospitals, I guess I have more questions about sort of what prenatal care does. But stress, I can't rule out stress for 1918 flu. I really can't. We have sort of an analogous type of comparison, and what we have in Sweden, which we didn't have in the U.S., is we basically have a lot more data to throw at the problem. Okay, so what we can do here is look at things like, is there a heterogeneity by family background, or what does it look like within the family? Okay, so we can do the comparisons in Sweden of, were you a sibling that was exposed prenatally to Chernobyl fallout while the other sibling was not? So that's sort of a departure from the previous work in fetal origins, which did sibling fixed effects, but in the absence of an identification strategy. This is sort of sibling fixed effects with an identification strategy. And an interesting thing, which I'm going to come back to in a little bit, is those estimates with the fixed effects and without the fixed effects, I, going into this, would have thought they'd be the same, okay? That was just sort of like an extra control variable. It was robust to inclusion of some additional controls. It's actually not the case. You find largest effects on math scores for these cohorts, which lines up to an earlier literature on the A-bomb drops on Japan and IQ of cohorts sort of around the hypocenter of the A-bomb drops. And they find the largest effects on sort of measures of IQ. Math maps most closely to IQ. We find it at these radiation doses that people thought should be harmless. And we don't see things on sort of more English or Swedish or language type things. It seems to be sort of heaping mainly onto the math. What I was going to say about the sibling fixed effects is I was surprised to see that when we do the sibling fix, we actually find much stronger within family estimates than when we do comparisons that also include across families. And I'll come back to that point in a little bit. Because that was a big surprise and it was a real puzzle. What I think it motivates, and Sweden's not the best place to do this because we don't have good data on parental investments that I know of, is to think about how parental investments respond to fetal origins. Okay, so policy implications. Avi Ebenstein, who's another Berkeley PhD, I'm not sure which of my papers he was ripping on. I think it was probably a famine paper. And he said, so what's the policy implication of this, that we shouldn't have famines? Like, we kind of already knew that one. which this is a pretty fair point, right? Like, I'm not going to convince anyone to not have a famine or a flu pandemic because, you know, in 50 years people aren't going to make as much money. You know, like we already know this is like a policy failure of some kind. So this is sort of the making the rubble bounce. Like who, you know, it's not going to be pivotal for policy that pandemics have long-term effects. So what that has motivated is the consideration of, you know, less extreme events. So things are less extreme and more commonly experienced. So in a way, this is sort of circling back to the earlier literature. So the earlier literature did look at less extreme events. So like there were studies of this 1958 British cohort and what's its birth weight and how are these guys doing later in life. The variation in birth weight wasn't that, you know, famine-induced birth weight. This was just like cross-sectional variation in birth weight. So you could think that was the less extreme variation. The problem was, you know, we really, or I at least really think that those types of comparisons are really set up for admitted variables bias, that birth weights correlate with all sorts of other stuff that's important that, you know, we're not sure we're doing a great job of sweeping out, absent in an experiment. So I think at this point, this literature that did use less extreme events, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, was in the absence of the sort of identification strategy revolution, it's viewed kind of as descriptive, which isn't to say it's like lousy. It's to say, you know, it motivated a lot of people to work on this. And so it sort of, it documents some interesting associations, but to sort of really put the knife in, people have gone to the natural experiments. And the challenge here is, can we sort of maintain the generality of the exposures considered and still have some identification strategy? That's the tension, I think. And I think that, you know, from my perspective, the literature has kind of succeeded in making this jump. It will require some larger data sets, but we'll come to that in a little bit. So, again, sort of being narcissistic and perhaps lazy, prenatal fasting during Ramadan. Okay, the Ramadan fast is determined by daylight hours, and there are various studies that say the total number of calories doesn't change, it's just the timing of nutrition, okay? And then, you know, I'll come to this in a second, but there are nice reasons for considering the Ramadan fast from an identification standpoint. There's recent work by Courtney Ward. She has a number of papers looking at seasonal influenza. So again, something that's not as traumatic as pandemic. And there's also stuff on weather and sort of a host of sort of milder, more commonly experienced exposures. I guess I would say, you know, the Chernobyl thing might tell us something about radon. So like a lot of people are exposed to radon, and that's pretty low level ionizing radiation. Maybe we think that there is some general to that. So this is, I would say, still a developing literature, but there are these sort of well-identified studies that consider things that are mild that might actually be pivotal for sort of whether we decide to sort of participate or not participate in, you know, this type of mild exposure as opposed to something more serious. So this is a paper from I guess like a year ago, where we use Ramadan. Bashman Zumander and I use Ramadan as a natural experiment. And the nice thing about Ramadan for analysis purposes is that it moves around the calendar. Okay, so I could never remember when Ramadan was, and it turns out the reason why I could never remember when Ramadan was because it was like moving 11 days every year. So we know that there are seasonal effects of seasonal effects on health, so birth outcomes and even long run outcomes are differing depending on when you were born. Well, we can sort of stop out those seasonal differences and focus on sort of the idiosyncratic movement of Ramadan around the calendar. And furthermore, we can also use variations stemming from the definition of the fast as being during daylight hours. So, if you're off the equator, unfortunately Uganda's on the equator, so we don't get that variation, and we do analyze Uganda. But if you're in Michigan or, you know, somewhere else, then you get that daylight variation as well. And we can sort of take an additional difference and see that effects indeed are larger when you're supposed to be fasting for longer. So we do two things here. One is we look at birth outcomes in Michigan, and then we sort of make the jump of looking to other countries and we're looking at Iraq and Uganda purely for data reasons. So maybe this sort of drives home the point of the data challenges with fetal origins research, that to implement an identification strategy like this, you want to know, you'd ideally like to know people's religion, you'd like to know exactly when they're born. Like, often you just have age. Age isn't going to cut it. Year of birth isn't going to cut it. You want at least quarter of birth and preferably month of birth. And the reason why we're in Uganda and Iraq is because they actually report the month of birth on the censuses, and Uganda reports the religion. So then we can sort of move forward from there. You can ignore the bottom. So Esther asked us to do this sort of, I think, in the spirit of a randomized controlled trials, is basically just conduct a balance test. So if you look over here, the nice thing about Ramadan is if you compare those births where there was exposure, so the effect of Ramadan occurring at any time during pregnancy on maternal education, it doesn't look like there's any difference. You can look just at Arabs in Michigan or the non-Arabs. It doesn't look like there's any differential likelihood by maternal education of having a birth during Ramadan. So it doesn't seem like, which maybe is this was a surprise when I presented at Chicago. People, I don't believe that people don't time their births with regard to Ramadan. Well, it doesn't look like they time their births with regard to Ramadan. So we get fat zeros here, and so we're breaking that link, which is very robust between SES and health with this natural experiment. So it does, so in the end, it's not gonna matter whether we control for education or not. Okay, that's sort of the game, is to sort of find a situation where what you control for is once you've identified that variation or isolated that variation that's important, then what you control for doesn't really matter that much. Nevertheless, we find impacts on birth weight. Okay, so these aren't like honking big noticeable effects on birth weight if this were your baby or something, but they're significant. So it suggests that there is indeed a first stage, that moms are observing the fast. Now, one thing to mention, and I actually didn't quite know where this fits in the presentation, but I wanted to flag it nonetheless, is pregnancy recognition. So, and maybe it's actually a good time to mention this right after having said what do they think at the University of Chicago. So University of Chicago, I don't think they'd be thinking so much about what are the policies, we can do to sort of improve fetal health, as much as, how can we give moms the information to make better informed decisions? And there is evidence from epidemiology that once moms know they're pregnant, their behavior changes, okay? And the big effects we found for Ramadan are actually, in that first month or two of pregnancy. So most of these moms don't know they're pregnant and they're fasting. Okay, if they knew they were pregnant a little earlier, then maybe maybe they wouldn't fast, or maybe they wouldn't do other things. But if you look at, the host of sort of lifestyle things, dieting, you know, drinking, smoking, these things, you know, change once people recognize they're pregnant. But that first little window before people learn they're pregnant can still be really important. So I think that's like, that's something that like we could agree with the Chicago people, that fostering earlier pregnancy recognition would cause individual behavioral change, but, you know, might also be, something we can target with policy, as well. Okay, so yes, we found long-run effects of that.
How's that evident in those results? You get the same.
Yes. Yeah. So that's for birth weight, where you really see the is in the long-run effects. Exactly. So this, I see this as showing that there was a first stage, but again, like I never see it very.
Not the channel.
Yeah, that's not the channel.
Not the only one.
Doesn't it? Not the only one. Exactly. Exactly.
Do you have data on gestational age? Because I wonder.
Yeah, right. So we do know gestational age, not in Uganda or Iraq, but we do know it in Michigan. And so we can assign Ramadan one of two ways. The dumb way, which is just to sort of count back and assume a, you know, normal pregnancy, or we can use that exact, well, depending on who you ask, but date of last menses is the usual thing that people use to do it, or they can do a clinical estimate of gestation. It turns out whether we do that, use that information or forget about that information, it doesn't really matter. We throw out about, I think, like 15% of our sample when we do that. It does look like there is a small effect on the duration of gestation, but most of this effect is conditional on gestation length, so intrauterine growth retardation. The point I want to make with this next slide here is essentially this is this is a study from Chicago. There's nothing to do with Ramadan per se. It's just about breakfast skipping. Okay. So what they did is they had pregnant moms, and they let them have dinner the night before, and then they brought them in, you know, like at 6 a.m. the following morning, 7 a.m. Okay, and then they monitored their blood biochemistry over time. Okay, and what was the really startling finding, if you look at glucose or free fatty acids, all this stuff, you see that as the fast, you know, extends from 12 hours, 14 hours, 16 hours, 18 hours, the blood biochemistry stays pretty stable in the non-pregnant population, but it goes pretty haywire in the non-pregnant population. And this sort of haywire of the blood biochemistry has a name from the diabetes literature, which is called accelerated starvation, because so, this behavior. Sorry.
We're just remembering.
It wasn't my imagination.
Okay.
I was pregnant.
Yeah. All hell was breaking loose. Yeah. This has been called accelerated starvation, and there have been a number of recent studies on Ramadan that show basically exactly this for Ramadan, that when you extend when the mom is fasting for Ramadan, then the blood biochemistry goes crazy. I think, actually, Bosch is working on this, but I think, you know, the leap from Ramadan to thinking about other sort of more commonly experienced, I mean, Ramadan is very commonly experienced, so I think the internal validity question is still really interesting. But I think it's less of a leap to go from Ramadan to things like breakfast skipping than it is to go from, you know, famine to other things. So I think I'm not saying it's complete or it's a perfect thing, but I think we're sort of filling in that a little bit. And so if you can think of a good design in breakfast skipping or this sort of thing, dieting, whatever, like that's going to be great to look at. Okay. So now, I want to sort of segue a little bit, to poverty. Okay. So, I had trouble making this slide just because I think it's something that's like so obvious to everybody. So I apologize for this. It's probably super, super obvious. Poor people experience worse prenatal environments on average. Okay. So if you look at something like neonatal mortality, which is mortality within the first 30 or 28 days, of life, that is thought to register the pretty well the prenatal environment, as opposed to postneonatal mortality, which is more like infection and accidents and stuff like that. And so if you stratify, I'm very proud of using the word stratify, the high SES from the bottom SES, well, indeed you find that there's a substantial gap in the neonatal mortality rates, which would suggest that there's differences in the prenatal environment. Similarly, Anna Iser has some nice work with the National Collaborative Perinatal Project data from the 1960s, where they collected really detailed data on an oversample of low SES households and measured things like cortisol. And cortisol is sort of a frequently invoked stress hormone that in laboratory studies where they can randomly do nasty things to pregnant mice or whatever, that you find effects on the next generation when you manipulate cortisol. And so she has a table that shows that those with normal cortisol levels during pregnancy have on average $42,000 in income, and those with high cortisol levels have lower income. So this is just to say, so if we think the fetal environment is really important and exerts these long-term effects on both health and SES, well, it quickly becomes very relevant the fact that, that poor people experience worse environments. So that's sort of one of the drags on subsequent outcomes. So, in terms of actual studies on fetal origins and policy, there are relatively few existing studies that look at this. And one of the reasons, I think, is that, you have the usual policy evaluation challenges, which everybody's really familiar with, plus this hungry longitudinal data requirement to be able to follow these cohorts forward. Okay, so that just makes it a tougher sort of thing. And again, it's if we had that metric of early life that captured this, then we could sort of we could look at the birth weight as I was there and say, okay, I think I have a good sense of what this policy is going to do in 30 years. But I don't think we have that metric. So there is this disconnect. I think that's a reason why we haven't had as many of these policy studies. That said, I think they're absolutely critical and useful. So I'm going to highlight a few of them, and I've probably omitted some. And then I'll turn to some other issues. So, food stamps rollout in the U.S., that's a paper that's been presented here. I'm not going to talk about that in much detail, just summarize the results. There's a fairly well-known paper by Peter Nilsson that looks in Sweden at a couple of counties where in, I think, end of 1967, they liberalized strong beer sales. And if you've been to Sweden, like, alcohol is really expensive, and it's why they all go, like, out on boats and get drunk, because then they don't have to pay the taxes there. But in 67, they liberalized the sales outside of the state liquor stores to sell strong beer in grocery stores, and basically it was just like, debauchery and drunkenness, and such that they had to stop the experiment 8 months later, okay? What he does is he looks at that cohort that happened to be in utero when suddenly, a lot of people were drinking like crazy. And again, this exercise of looking at the ones that were conceived prior. Ward, so the same Ward that I mentioned before, she has a paper which I'm going to admit I haven't read but looks really intriguing on school immunization policies. So basically, when different states adopted different immunization requirements, she looks at the cohort that was in utero then, so they would have experienced sort of like a herd benefit of having the older kids immunized, and finds long-run effects on outcomes of that. I mentioned this land reform in China for two reasons. One is, I'm going to talk about land reform in China tomorrow, so if you can stand another talk, that'll be me. The other reason is land reform has been called the largest anti-poverty program in the history of the world because it lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. So basically, they decollectivized agriculture, and people gained a lot of agricultural income by being able to farm for themselves. And their long-term effects of that. Okay, I'm actually not talking about the long-term effects tomorrow. I'm talking about short-term effects. But that's another instance where we can map the policy to later life outcomes. And I'm guessing there's a WIC project in the works of long-run effects of WIC. Is that true?
I think Maya might be.
Okay. All right. But maybe this is to highlight the need for additional studies, and I've probably omitted some. I was thinking that the Nick Sanders study was a policy one, but then that's the recession, not the long-run effects of the Clean Air Act amendment. So I was sort of scratching my head for other studies, but I'm hopeful that there will be more soon.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.